Islamic Relief USA is a nonprofit organization that provides relief and development in a dignified manner regardless of gender, race, or religion, and works to empower individuals in their communities and give them a voice in the world.
You done now? Can we start the podcast?
Okay.
Alhamdulillah wa salatu wa salamu ala rasulillah wa ala alihi wa sahbihi wa man wala.
It's a Water Relief podcast.
My name is Carl, and here with me...
Or are Mortimon. One of those two is correct.
I have messed this up yet again.
Assalamu alaikum. Welcome back to the Water Relief Podcast. Thank you everybody for listening, sharing, download, and repeating. We want to thank everyone for all their downloads, for all the comments, for all the shares, for all the likes, and for all of you being fans of the work that we do, because we enjoy the work that we do. We enjoy bringing the programs and the people that IRUSA works with to you so that you have a better understanding of what we do here at IRUSA. And to be honest, we really love our job, don't we, Morden?
Yes, we do. We enjoy the voodoo that we do so well.
And for those of you that don't know, that was a Mel Brooks reference. And now you and I are making ourselves look very old.
Yeah, I think it was actually Harvey Korman that said it.
It was. With that, and that's a throwback to Carol Burnett. So, but we got just a touch ahead of ourselves there. Ladies and gentlemen, the hardest working man in the podcast industry.
Hi, this is Mordant, and you've already introduced me, but we have somebody even more interesting, even more better, which is bad grammar, but who cares? More better on the line, and why don't you introduce our guest right now?
I shall do that. Assalamu alaikum, and thank you for joining us, Hadia. How are you today?
I'm doing wonderful. Thank you so much for having me on the show. I appreciate it.
Well, thank you for joining us. And just for our listening audience, you are joining us from?
I'm joining you from Charlotte, North Carolina.
North Carolina. How's the weather down there?
It's beautiful. I'm in Gastonia, which is right next to Charlotte, North Carolina.
That's unbelievable. That's like 20 minutes south of here, I think.
Wow. Who'd have thunk?
I'll pay you a surprise visit next time. I'm in Gastonia, inshallah.
All right. Well, you can come up to the Carolina Renaissance Festival. I'm working there on the weekends.
Okay. Sounds good. I'm new to Charlotte, I should say. I grew up in the Panhandle in Panama City, Florida, and then for the last 12 years prior to last year, I was in the D.C. suburbs, Northern Virginia.
Right. Yeah, very cool. All right. Small world, which is what we're all about here, showing everybody all the similarities and how much alike we are and how we are working together for a better, albeit
for a
small
better
world.
Oh, darn it. Messed that up again.
One day we'll get all that together.
For a great America, right?
Yeah, we're not touching that one. Moving right along. Hadia, you are joining us today because you wrote about an article, or you wrote an article about the ISPU study for the religious literacy gap that is happening in America among Muslim children.
Muslim youth. More precise.
How is that for working without notes?
That's a big title. What does that even mean?
That means is, so there was a convening conducted by the Institute for Social Policy and Understanding to try to identify what were the key aspects of these religious literacy gaps. So what that means is in Muslim youth's, first of all, in terms of their understanding of the Islamic tradition, in terms of the pedagogy, so the teaching that is actually taking place in Muslim schools or Islamic studies curricula throughout the country, what are some of the gaps that need to be filled? And the idea was that this, the results of this convening, the findings would be useful to Muslim communities, to educational centers, and anyone really who is interested in the field of religious literacy and promoting religious literacy.
Can you define what religious literacy is?
So religious literacy is really having a clear understanding of one's, of a religion, right? It doesn't have to be one's own religion. It could be any religion beyond just doctrine and ritual and practices, beyond what is normally taught in a Sunday school kind of class, but really having an understanding of the history, of the practices, normative practices of this tradition, of the tradition as a whole, through a kind of interdisciplinary approach, looking at, you know, different sources, not just religious texts, but really looking at different sources of the religion, looking at, you know, again, primarily history, maybe anthropology, maybe sociology, but trying to have a really clear understanding of the religion and where it fits in context of the world in which we live currently, and in context of, you know, of what's happened in history, right? And it just creates a more wholesome, and really this is one of the key findings, was that the concern for the gaps in religious literacy really stems from this larger concern for helping Muslim youth have a more wholesome and healthy sense of identity. Because these religious gaps or these gaps in religious literacy could lead to misunderstanding. It could lead to extremism, as we've seen in some cases. And it could also just lead to a lot of confusion as to what does it mean to be Muslim in today's age. And this is obviously an important issue for many reasons. But one reason is because Muslim youth today are increasingly put in a situation where they are asked to answer questions about their religion that they might have no clue how to answer. And we're finding that this starts as young as elementary school. You know, as young as elementary school, questions arise sometimes in the classroom, in classroom settings with the teacher and students involved, sometimes reading certain texts related to events that are happening in our country, such as 9/11. You know, and Muslim youth are having this challenge of feeling that a sense of responsibility that they want to represent their faith, or they want to answer questions, but not really knowing how, or not really having the knowledge and information they need.
So this is also practical application of everything that they have learned as well, and being also and on another level too, being able to tell the difference between what is actually in the religion and what is just a cultural moray.
Yes, absolutely.
Because one of the things that we've seen here in working on the show is that sometimes there's people get caught up with, well, actually the you know, Islam means this, and actually it's like, well, no, it doesn't say that. It doesn't say that in the Quran. It doesn't say that in the tenets. But and what you have right in that is a cultural, you know, something that's brought up by a culture and not necessarily and is being applied to Islam. And there's confusion there too, and especially here in America, where people are like, well, this is what it means to be Islamic. It's like, no, actually, when you read it, it's not that. And you're confusing, you know, a different country's culture with what's actually in the religion. Are you finding? Sorry for my long rant here, but are you finding that the Muslim youth are sometimes confused, or are they well read and spot on, or?
Yeah, well, you know, this convening wasn't necessarily this was a convening of experts in different fields. We had people in sociology, people in youth leadership, people in psychology, people who teach. So I teach Islamic studies in academia and higher education. So different types. So we weren't necessarily, you know, we brought all of this knowledge together. But this issue that you're mentioning, however, does exist absolutely in Muslim communities as well, where there tends to be this distortion between, you know, what is Islam, what is not. And also what we're trying, you know, one of the issues that was raised in this convening is how to help Muslim youth in general understand or distinguish between three different things, basically. One being Islam's textual sources, right? The Quran, like as you mentioned, you know, the sacred text, the primary text for Muslims, the hadith, prophetic narrations, and then the interpretive tradition, right? How to distinguish these, how to distinguish the textual sources from the interpretive tradition. What do I mean by the interpretive tradition? That would be basically then the body or the scholastic disciplines, right, that have interpreted these texts and have said, this is what Islamic law is. This is what, you know, this is what these verses mean. So that would be captured in Quranic commentaries or exegesis. So that's all part of the interpretive tradition. And a lot of things, as you point out, might not be in the text, but might come from the interpretive tradition, right? It might be mentioned by jurists and scholars throughout the ages, throughout the centuries. And so one of the things that we're trying to help youth understand also is the plurality of this interpretive tradition, the fact that, you know, not all scholars throughout history said the same thing, that there's been this diversity, a very healthy diversity. So diversity within Islamic law, for example, that there's this legal pluralism, and there isn't, you know, there were fundamental differences on important things, even regarding rituals, you know, even regarding some aspects of doctrine. And we're also trying to help them, you know, understand the diversity of the cultural variations of Islamic practices, right? So that Islam has manifested itself differently in different cultures, in different geographic locations. And that has always been a healthy part of Islam. And you know, then this diversity of historical context, that there's been in whatever given issue, right? Whether we talk about women in Islam or we talk about jihad, for example, that there are certain historical contexts in which the position of the jurists also changed. You know, I mean, for example, I just came out of a class a little bit ago. We're talking about women in the prophetic period, and we're looking at how in the Mamluk period, which comes after the Abbasid period, the biographers who were collecting these narrations portrayed and depicted the role of women very differently than the earlier biographers did, right? And that was because of the historical context. The milieu in which they were living was a little bit more patriarchal, and there was a certain idea of what a woman's proper role should be, and that this influences the way women are then depicted in some of these texts. So, you know, we're trying to help youth understand that there's always been this healthy diversity within the interpretive tradition. I mentioned these two sources, you know, being able to distinguish between the text, the interpretive tradition, and the third thing being normative practices of Muslims. And what I mean by that is how Muslims actually live Islam, right? And some of that has to do with culture rather than, you know, any text, right? So those were the three areas we're trying to get them to distinguish. Sorry for being very long-winded.
If I'm to understand, you guys are almost building a course of some sort for the youth to fill in the gaps of their understanding of the religious background.
Well, so basically there are recommendations made by the report. And one recommendation is that a curriculum be developed for Islamic studies that would include all of these components that we're talking about, you know, include the diversity of thought, diversity, you know, not just diversity, and as well as diversity of sects, you know, the fact that there are different sects. So including material about the Shia tradition, where sometimes, you know, Sunnis don't know enough about the Shia, Shia don't know enough about Sunnis. And, you know, so that's the one of the goals, is that, you know, that a curriculum be developed. But ISPU itself is not going to create this curriculum itself. It's basically putting out recommendations for how it should be developed, and as well as, you know, pointing out the literacy gaps in general. And some other gaps, you know, there we identified based on the convening that I haven't mentioned, is, you know, the need to embrace new ways of learning that really focus on emotional intelligence, critical thinking, and engage learning. So we're also not just focusing on content, but on the way Islam is taught in these different arenas, and that it needs to be taught in a way that embraces critical thinking, that encourages youth to ask the questions that they want to ask. And this is also related to another finding, which is that there is a need to create safe spaces for youth where they can ask difficult and controversial questions, you know, whether it has to do with race, with homosexuality, with gender, with politics, you know, with secularism, atheism, etc., that there needs to be a space where youth can actually ask these questions and feel comfortable doing so.
So as a professor yourself, what do you see as being a potential and effective delivery method of this sort of curriculum and this sort of teaching, this information? That, because obviously the information needs to be disseminated, but and you're a professor of higher education, so what do you see as the best method to make that happen?
Well, are you talking about in the classroom, or just to make sure I understand your question, like in the classroom itself, or?
Well, that's kind of my question to you, is it more effective so would it be more effective just to do this in a traditional, you know, Sunday school setting? Is it more would it be better to have it taught as a regular course inside a school? Is this something, should we print a how-to book and give it to every parent so that they know how to speak to their kids about these things? What do you see as an effective delivery method of these courses that you guys are developing, or these courses that you guys are recommending be designed?
Yeah, so that's a good question. The idea is that these recommendations would then be adopted by different institutions and centers where there is already some sort of instruction of Islam going on. So there would be a host of different places that would adopt these recommendations, some of them being Sunday schools, as you mentioned, some being full-time Islamic schools, some being, you know, educational centers that are teaching Islam, maybe not just to Muslims, but to mixed audiences. And then you also have programs throughout the summer, throughout the year, especially during the holidays, programs out there conducted by different Muslim institutions or organizations that focus on Islamic education. And so we're hoping that some of these centers and institutions would also adopt these recommendations. And as you mentioned, even parents as well, right? There are some parents maybe who are homeschooling their children or take it upon themselves. So we're hoping these recommendations would be adopted, you know, across. And one of the later steps that ISP is planning to take is to, you know, convene with these different groups, right? To have something specifically for youth leaders, for example, in mosques and in different, and to, you know, and then maybe something with educators. So that's sort of the next step.
Fantastic. Now, you said something about, and I like what you're talking about, diversity and being able to teach that within the, you know, the Muslim group. But I also like the fact that you're teaching, reaching out and teaching what Islam is in a diverse group, you know, not just Muslims, but also other people, so that, that, you know, we can all see behind the veil and go, oh, this is, you know, where there's, we all fear the unknown. And with some of the bad press that's been out there, there's even more fear. If you can pull back the veil and go, this is actually what it is. This is what Islam is, and this is here. Look, and here's Muslims, so you can meet them. And if there's a way to integrate people together, I'm a big fan of that. How is that aspect of this project moving forward? And what can we do to help?
Yes. No, absolutely. I think that's very important. And I think, you know, as someone who teaches Islam, I teach actually at UNCC, I point out to my students oftentimes that, you know, and obviously it's a secular institution, you know, my students come from all sorts of backgrounds, that some of this information, you know, that they're learning is not readily available even to Muslim youth. You know, people, there tends to be a lot of misunderstanding sometimes. And as we're seeing right now in a very politicized climate, you know, where you have leaders at the highest level of this country who are asking questions, very basic questions and important questions about Islam, you know, that is there some sort of clash of civilization going on? For example, is Islam at war with the West? And what do we make, for example, of verses in the Quran that are exploited by extremists, by terrorists, right? How do we understand the context of these verses? What are these verses? Or how do we know, you know, a question that arises from multi-faith groups sometimes is how do we know that the Islam ISIS is practicing is not the real thing, right? And that other Muslims have just watered it down. And there's all these questions that Muslims themselves are struggling with and sometimes unable to answer because they don't know, right? Because they don't know. And so this is definitely an interfaith effort in the sense that, you know, the need for this religious literacy is for all people, and these questions are being asked by people from all different backgrounds. And so increasing Muslim youth literacy will ultimately increase the literacy of people throughout the country because, you know, Muslim youth are engaging with people in different settings, whether at work or at school or, you know, many different arenas. And so this is really a very, very important issue. And so we're hoping that also when it comes to interfaith groups, you know, maybe they will look into these recommendations as well. Or Muslims who speak, who go and, you know, you have a lot of Muslims, for example, there's this Muslim Speakers Bureau, or I think they call it Islamic Speakers Bureau, that they will, you know, consider these angles that the ISP is recommending.
Just because you touched on it ever so briefly, and I don't want any of our first-time listeners to be confused at all, can you take a step back and clarify what you were saying about how do the youth know that ISIS isn't the real Islam and the rest of the world practices a watered down version of it? Because that statement by itself, just taken, you know, out of context, could be real bad looking. And we try to avoid that. So if you could just clarify that a little bit, that would be awesome.
Yeah, no, absolutely. I apologize for that, confusion. What I meant is really the questions that people are asking from other faiths, you know, that they're asking Muslim youth to answer, or they're asking Muslims in general to answer is, you know, how do we know that, you know, you being the mainstream Muslims, that this is actually Islam, right? And this is so what I mean by that is that this is one of the issues confronting Muslims today, and especially Muslim youth. And so there's a need to respond to those kind of questions. But absolutely, I mean, Muslims, and this is data, right? I mean, you could look up data from the Pew Forum, look up data, especially the Gallup poll has done a lot capturing the sentiments of Muslims throughout the world, that there is absolutely, that there is no sympathy for terrorism, for extremism. And then also in looking at the religious tradition itself, and this is not the topic of our talk, but, you know, looking at the religious tradition, anyone who has really engaged the tradition, engaged the text, it's absolutely clear. So for Muslim youth, it is a very clear answer, right? But the difficult part, so it's very clear for them, obviously, that Islam rejects extremism, Islam rejects the killing of innocent people. And they know this because, you know, there are different ways, right, that they've come to this conclusion, whether it's what they've been taught by their parents or from reading the Quran, from learning the prophetic biography. I mean, that's one of the most important sources. But my point was to really kind of highlight the fact that this is a question that comes up oftentimes, and they, you know, there is a need to kind of respond to it. And sometimes they're not equipped with the right resources to try to, you know, articulate like coherently and in a compelling way how this is not Islam. Does that make sense to you?
I have a question. You're teaching this in schools here in North Carolina. How are these being received? How is your teaching being received from both the Muslim community and non-Muslims here?
Well, it's actually being received really well. I taught last year for a year at Davidson College as well.
Mm-hmm. And, Davidson real well.
Yeah. So I was a visiting professor at Davidson College last year, and this year I'm at UNCC. And my course evaluations, you know, at both places have been, you know, thanks to God, you know, very, very high. And my students actually oftentimes come and tell me that, you know, this is one of their favorite courses, and they feel very engaged in the classroom. They feel very engaged because of the material that's being covered, but also because of the approach I take, where I ask them a lot of questions and I ask them to consider certain aspects, you know, of what we're covering. And to, you know, I ask a lot of questions. I provide a lot of opportunities to kind of think critically about the material. And I'm also, my approach in general is just having this academic honesty where any question can be asked. And, you know, and I'm not in any way apologetic, you know, or defensive. And so I think the attitude helps in general.
You also discussed, I'm sorry, I'm jumping around a lot, but you covered a lot of stuff that's really interesting. You discussed women's issues in the Muslim world and teaching, especially with the older text that sometimes you often have to take it in context of what was happening at the time. So although it may say, you know, one thing as far as where women's role in the world, that's not necessarily the, you know, the way things are now. If you look at the context, you can understand that. Am I missing the boat on that, or am I accurate? And how is that being received if you're teaching that?
Yes. So actually, I teach a course, an entire course called Women and Gender in Islam. And this is a course I'm teaching this fall, Women and Gender in Islam. And we look at women in the Quran, women in the prophetic history, and then women in law and women in exegesis. And then we look at various issues such as marriage and divorce and, you know, adultery, for example. And I mentioned to you, we pay attention to these different sources, right? Is this coming from the Quran? Is this coming from a prophetic tradition? Is this coming from a legal opinion, for example, a legal perspective that was articulated by men, right? throughout a certain period in history. So, for example, the issue of women's leadership. Can a woman be head of state? There was a controversy about this, even though, so I really portrayed to them kind of the, sometimes I don't want to say contradictions, but things that would seem to be contradicting. So on one hand, we have Queen Sheba in the Quran. Queen Sheba was the was at the time of Solomon, portrayed in a very positive light as this wise leader who takes counsel from her delegation. And really, she's the only political leader we have in the Quran who's portrayed in a very positive light and who embraces the truth when she recognizes it, who's humble, who tries to avoid wars, seeks diplomacy, sends Solomon a gift. But then we have this prophetic tradition which says something to the extent of any nation or people who delegate their affairs to a woman will not succeed, right? And so we ask this question of how do we reconcile these two different attitudes towards female political leadership? And one way is we have to actually look at this tradition, right? And where it comes from and who narrated it, but also what were the consequences of having this tradition is that there ends up being kind of a legal controversy as to whether or not women could be heads of state. But then we also look at Muslim majority countries today and how many of them have actually elected heads of state, such as Pakistan has had a female prime minister, Indonesia, Turkey, Bangladesh, Mali, many Mauritius, many Muslim majority countries that have actually, either Muslim majority countries or countries with significant Muslim populations have elected women as heads of state. So, they kind of see this range of views and perspectives and then what's actually happening on the ground. So I don't know if that helps, but that's just kind of one example to kind of illustrate what we do.
Oh, that was great. That was great. Can you give us a personal story or something of how this is affecting people, how it's affected you, whether it's while you're in the classroom or elsewhere where your work is actually, making it real?
Let me think. There are a lot of stories I have to share. I mean, one that affected me the most, honestly, was this one individual who, first of all, didn't, he wasn't showing up to class. And then when he'd show up, he'd sit all the way in the back. There were only 18 students in the class or maybe a little bit less. And so there was no need for him to sit all the way in the back. And his head was always kind of in a laptop and not really. So I kind of followed up with him several times, trying to get him more engaged. And he really turned around towards the second half of the semester and became more involved, more engaged. And I made sure he was doing the readings because a lot of the knowledge that's going to come is not just from the lectures, but they have to read the assignments, right? And so what I found, because he became more engaged and he was doing the readings and listening more carefully, his views had dramatically changed. And I obviously had no idea of what presuppositions he had coming into the classroom. But he himself tells the entire class at the very end of the semester, they're doing their final presentations, and he says, you guys used to see me sitting in the back. Well, I want to let you know, it was because of my ignorance and because I asked myself, what can a Muslim woman teach me about this? He kind of was skeptical because of me being a Muslim woman. And also I happened to cover my hair and he just, felt that he couldn't possibly learn anything from me. And that was the reason. I obviously had no idea, but the fact that he came around and even admitted this and acknowledged and told everyone, acknowledges and just by, encouraging his engagement and, showing concern for his, showing concern for him passing the class. And he was at a certain point going to make an F and then he passed with a B. And I was very happy about that because I consider it my responsibility, not just to educate, but really to see students succeed and thrive and do well. And I really consider that a success story in my career, if I can say that.
Since you teach at a, correct me,
UNCC.
Well, I was going to say, correct me if I'm wrong, but can we say a secular school? Is that a good word to use?
Yeah, it's a public university.
Okay.
So it's, yeah.
What kind of students do you have showing up for these kind of courses? I'm just wondering because, your story went one direction, but I had another thing in my head, and I thought you were going a totally different direction with that, and then I was like, but if this kid didn't want to be there, why was he signing up for this course in the first place? Because every course I've taken, I've signed up for because I wanted to be there to learn something. So what kind of students do you see enrolling in your courses?
And I guess you don't mean by their academic performance, right? But just students in terms of their backgrounds?
Yeah. A demographics background.
You know, at Davidson, I would say it's primarily, you know, white, and then a lot of them are middle upper class as well, because Davidson tends to attract, it's one of the most expensive universities in the country, so it attracts a certain demographic. I mean, you know, and because of how expensive it is, also, and it's also very rigorous, so they're also very educated, and I had very, very smart students who were very eager to learn, as you mentioned. At UNCC, it's a public university. It's a little bit different, but it's a little bit more diverse, I should say, which is always a refreshing thing. It's more diverse. But usually I do have like one or two Muslim students, but not that many. The majority tend to be non-Muslim at both institutions. And at UNCC, I've had a mix of African-American, white, maybe some Hispanic, Latino, sometimes Asian. That tends to be the mix. A lot of them come into class with no prior knowledge of Islam. So this tends to be the first class they've taken on Islam. Sometimes that requires some introductory material. But most of the students come, they're very, very interested and very engaged. Every now and then, you know, you have a few students who, I'm not sure why they signed up, because they're either absent or not engaged. But it's been a very rewarding experience, because the students are just excellent.
That's fantastic. So if somebody wants to find out more about, now I'm not even sure if we're promoting these classes specifically, or if we're promoting your program, or what we should be promoting here, but this, whatever it is, whatever you're selling, I'm buying it. So what do you want to promote today? Where are we going with this?
I'm really promoting more, you know, knowledge, more literacy, and you know, encouraging people to go find more accurate information. And this message is also for Muslims and Muslim communities, that just because someone grew up Muslim, learning Islam from their household or from their mosque, doesn't mean that they've really properly understood what Islam is and what the Islamic tradition consists of. Especially, as I mentioned, looking at aspects of history, of the diversity of these disciplines, of the interpretive tradition. And I would just kind of encourage people to try to gain a better understanding of Islam, both Muslims and non-Muslims, right? And to really have more precise information. I think we live in a day and time when, unfortunately, ignorance kind of can feign itself as expertise, where people, especially in light of the ignorance that exists about Islam, they're, you know, you have people who come to, who sometimes are on TV speaking on Islam, who really have just no credentials, and people can't call them out on it, because our societal level of understanding is just so low that people can't call them out on it and say this is just absolutely untrue. You know, and we're even seeing this very dangerous trend among leaders of this country, you know, where they are saying things about Islam that are absolutely false, just inaccurate. And I think, you know, as human beings, and especially being in academia, we should value truth. We should value honesty. We should value facts, right? And that's really kind of my message.
So specifically, is there a program that, you know, or a place where they can find your program, or something that's putting this forward that they can get more involved with, or at least find out more about, instead of just a general, you know, find out more information somewhere?
Yes. Yeah, that's a good question. You know, there are, I mean, difficult to answer, because there isn't, you know, one place that's doing this or one person that's doing this. But, you know, if you're a Muslim youth and you're interested in you know, increasing your religious literacy, I would recommend a program called ALIM. It's called ALIM, American Learning Institute for Muslims, for example. ISPU obviously is one place to go to find research on Muslim Americans in general, ISPU being Institute for Social Policy and Understanding. And especially for educators, I think it's important for them to engage in ISPU's work and research to really make sure that they are helping fill these literacy gaps. And I think if, you know, for people of other faiths, I would recommend, you know, that they reach out to, you know, scholars either in their community, or there is a list. ISPU, actually, one of the resources they provide for communities throughout the country, is they have a list of scholars and what their expertise is. And what I mean by scholars are experts on Muslims in America, and each of them have a different area of specialization or knowledge. And I would highly recommend, you know, looking at that database and, you know, the scholars who are affiliated with ISPU and maybe reaching out to them, have them come to their communities and speak on a given topic. So I hope that that clarifies your question.
Hi, Dia. We want to thank you for taking time out of your busy schedule to join us today. Thank you for all the just amazing, wonderful, and obviously educational material that you have shared with us today. You've given us a lot of resources, so everybody, and I feel like we all have homework. You know, the professor has assigned you all information, told you what websites to go to, so now go do your homework and be good little boys and girls.
Thank you so much for having me on the show. I really appreciate it, and I hope I look forward to meeting you in Gastonia.
Yeah, excellent, excellent.
So with that, we will say assalamu alaikum, and thank you once again to Hadia, and thank you, Morten.
Thank you.
So until next time, assalamu alaikum.
My name is Carl, and here with me...
or are Morten Mon. One of those two is correct.
I have messed this up yet again.
Yeah, I didn't know where you were going with all of that as well.
What are we doing?
Let's do it badly, and then we can do it better.
Oh, excellent. That's the way I like to do it.
Spoiler alert, spoiler alert.
Can we try that again? 1, 2, 3, together for a better world. More stories, less yap.
What?
Yup.
That was just, it was so real.